It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up on Central Time, people in developing countries are using low-tech strategies to deal with climate change. We learn about that and other science news with Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine. First, late last Friday, a Dane County's circuit court judge struck down Wisconsin's right-to-work law. The law, which stops unions from requiring private sector employees to pay union dues regardless of whether or not they're members, was signed in March 2015 and made Wisconsin the 25th right-to-work state. Critics of this kind of legislation say the laws weaken unions by allowing some workers to be, in effect, free riders. It extends unions' benefits like collective bargaining to all employees, including those that don't pay union dues. The new ruling may be short-lived, and appeal is expected. Many observers say the state Supreme Court would ultimately overturn Friday's decision and restore the right-to-work law. Here to tell us more is Paul Secunda. He's a professor of law and director of the Labor and Employment Law Program at Marquette University. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me back.
On what grounds did this circuit court judge say that the right-to-work law was unconstitutional?
Based on the ground that requiring a union to provide non-paying non-members with the same representational services provided due-paying members is an unconstitutional taking. To maybe make it a little bit more concrete, the law requires one private party, the union, to give their property, union services, to another private party, here the non-paying non-member employees, and that compulsion has to be assessed under the takings clause. And under that framework, we have a property taking, which has no public purpose and has no compensation. And so that's a violation of the state constitution's takings clause.
And the argument from supporters of right-to-work laws seemed to be, well, on the other hand, if you make that non-member of the union pay dues, it may be forcing them to pay money for political action, political expression by that union that they don't agree with, saying that raises constitutional issues of its own. Is there something to the other side of that argument?
There is nothing to the other side of that argument. That issue was decided in the 1980s. We make a distinction in labor law between chargeable and non-chargeable dues. Non-chargeable dues are exactly the ones that you were just referring to, political and ideological dues, and non-members do not have to pay for them. They can file forms to get any kind of that money back and not to support the union's agenda. Chargeable dues are for grievance processing and collective bargaining. By its very nature, it's non-political. It provides a benefit to all people who are under the union's representation. That's what we're talking about here.
Have we seen similar arguments that we saw on Friday from this judge, similar rulings that a right-to-work law constitutes a taking, a seizure?
We have. In Indiana and also in the federal Seventh Circuit, which includes Indiana, Illinois, and Wisconsin, we saw some action in this area in 2013 and 2014. Initially, the side saying this was an unconstitutional taking were successful at the initial level, although eventually both the Indiana Supreme Court and the Seventh Circuit said that this was not unconstitutional. What I found most interesting was that Judge Wood, who's the chief judge of the Seventh Circuit, said that she thought it was an unconstitutional taking, again saying that this seems to be a situation where the state law is compelling one private party to give their property to another private party and doing so without a public purpose or without compensation. I believe that's what Judge Faust, the trial judge here in Dane County Circuit Court, cited to in his opinion, and that seems to be the main disagreement between the two sides.
Is there anything unique about Wisconsin's version of the right-to-work law that might make it more or less susceptible to legal challenge?
Actually, it's the exact same law that is in 26 different states now. There are 26 right-to-work states, and they have uniformity in saying that non-member do not have to pay any types of fees to the unions, even though the unions are bound by law to represent them. The union has a duty of fair representation towards non-paying and paying members, and so there really isn't anything unique in the sense that you have a takings clause, which is similar under the federal constitution, under our state constitution, and you have these right-to-work laws, which do seem to permit such an unconstitutional taking. I guess this is just a debate that continues forward, first occurring in Indiana a few years ago, now moving to Wisconsin.
Talking to Paul Secunda, a professor of law, labor expert at Marquette University, looking at last Friday afternoon's ruling overturning Wisconsin's right to work law, just over a year really since it was signed into law. Paul, do you know if we've seen much impact of this law on union membership? And we're talking private sector unions here, not the public employee unions. Have we seen much change in the year since this law came into effect?
It's too soon to say. The law just went into effect in March 2015, and based upon what has occurred in other states, it usually takes 3 or 4 years for us to say with any definitive way that this has had an impact on the unions or the number of employers who are coming now to the state of Wisconsin. I will tell you that in other states, such as Michigan, for instance, there has been a dramatic impact as far as right to work on the number of unions and the number of members of unions. So it's still to be seen, but generally speaking, the impact of right to work laws is to lessen the presence of unions and make it easier for employers to impose the terms and conditions that they choose in their workplaces.
So we saw this ruling in this Dane County Circuit Court on Friday. What do you see happening next? An appeal seems almost certain.
I think it's going to follow exactly what happened with Act 10 litigation. If you recall, Act 10 had similar provisions with regard to public sector unions in Wisconsin. And what happened there in September of 2012 was that initially the then Attorney General Van Hollen filed a motion to stay with the Circuit Court in Dane County. The Circuit Court in Dane County denied that motion, but then it was appealed to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, which upheld the motion to stay, citing the fact that it would cause confusion across the state until that time that the Wisconsin Supreme Court could rule on it. Eventually, the Wisconsin Supreme Court did rule on it, and in the spring of 2014, in the Madison Teachers case, they found that Act 10 was constitutional in all regards. I suspect something similar here. I believe that initially there will be a motion to stay granted so that the status quo will be maintained as this decision is challenged, and in the next 12 to 18 months, I would suspect that this will eventually be decided by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. As everyone knows, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, as of last week with the elections, has now 5 conservatives and 2 progressives. So chances are that this decision by the Dane County Circuit Court judge is going to be overturned.
Does this actually change much on the ground between Friday's ruling and any kind of possible stay from a higher court while it waits for the Supreme Court? Can unions get something done while they're waiting here?
They might try to. In fact, with this decision still in force, there is an argument that the right to work law is no longer constitutional and they can start collecting fees from non-members. The problem is, by the time they get that entire process up and running, that motion to stay might be already in effect. So you might see a number of unions just wait and see what happens in the coming weeks rather than rushing to collect additional fees right now.
The tide around the nation seems to be a gradual increase of the number of right-to-work states, and the courts, by and large, seem to be going along with that. But do you see, you mentioned that Indiana case, now this ruling from a circuit court judge in Dane County, do you see maybe those rulings starting to snowball and have a precedent effect, even if they're overturned by high courts?
I think it's important for 2 reasons. First of all, I think it, again, highlights the fact that there is a real free rider problem with these laws, that unions are required by law to provide these services to all their employees. And so it's unfair for people to take advantage of the union services and not have to pay for them. So it highlights that again. I think it also means that even if there's not eventual success here in Wisconsin as far as overturning the right to work law, that there's going to be other states. Most prominently, the most recent right to work state this year in February was West Virginia. If West Virginia follows the same tactic and does so federally, there is a chance that it makes its way to the Fourth Circuit, which is the federal circuit that covers West Virginia. And if the West Virginia Federal Appellate Court, the Fourth Circuit, should follow Judge Wood's decision in the Seventh Circuit, which was the dissenting decision, and find this is an unconstitutional taking, well, then all of a sudden, we have a circuit split. And of course, if there's a circuit split, then it becomes ripe for Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court review. And of course, we have no idea what the United States Supreme Court's going to look like in 2017. All things are possible at this point. So this could be the beginning of something very important, perhaps not in Wisconsin, but perhaps nationally. This could be the beginning of a movement of finding right-to-work laws unconstitutional under the Takings Clause, even though such right-to-work laws have been permitted federally since 1947.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me again. It's always a pleasure.
That's Paul Secunda. He's a professor of law and director of the Labor and Employment Law Program at Marquette University. He talked to us about the future of the right-to-work law in Wisconsin after it was struck down in a circuit court on Friday. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at magazine covers, body image, and the plus-size label after a controversy involving comedian Amy Schumer and Glamour magazine. First, violence is part of the human condition, something our species has engaged in for millennia. But the science behind our violent behaviors led to some interesting theories, like how being violent might be linked to being bipedal, walking on two legs. Gemma Tarlak is here to explain these theories and other things we might not have known about violence, as well as some other interesting headlines from the science world. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hello, my friend. How are you doing?
Well, I'm good. Now, Gemma, before we get violent, I want to talk about a couple of the other big stories. One of them you brought us is fingerprinting diseases. How do we do this?
This is a really exciting emerging field, and the fancy term for it is immune repertoire sequencing. And basically, in our body, in our immune system, we have these special cells that kind of develop little segments of DNA. We're calling them barcodes because that's the easiest way to understand them, that you get this barcode in your immune cell, and it basically says, hey, I've recognized a threat, say, influenza, and I developed this barcode that says, yes, I've encountered this threat. Scientists are learning how to sequence all the different barcodes in our individual immune systems and read them to understand what kind of threats we've been exposed to, potentially what kind of diseases we are in the earliest stages of developing. It's a really fascinating field with a lot of different aspects to it.
Yeah, so I could see that being a great early warning system, maybe at the individual level, maybe at the societal level. But could there be a problem with false positives? Hey, we fingerprinted this disease. It's never going to affect you. We don't know that we're going to treat it anyway. I could see pros and cons here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And just to be clear, they are at the very, very early stages of sorting this all out. And there is the risk of false positives. Obviously, you don't want to go through very invasive, tough treatments like, say, chemotherapy, for example, if you don't really have the disease. So there's a lot of refinement going on. But one of the really interesting areas and one of the most advanced areas, there's a company out of Seattle, I believe, that has actually developed a simple blood test for certain types of cancers that can not only tell if the cancer is present, but it can also pick up a relapse months before tumors are seen in the CAT scan. So it's very early in the field, and it's definitely emerging, it's definitely refining, but it's a really exciting area.
And as I understand it, there's a prospect that this could help us figure out why vaccines work in some people, not in others. We can in effect, fingerprint the impact of vaccines.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, in older people, older folks are one of the highest risk category groups for getting, say, the annual avian influenza when it comes through our society. And there are actually ways of figuring out how to fine-tune the vaccine based on the person's, again, DNA barcode to actually make it much more effective. That's another really interesting area. But it's early on in the work. So don't expect, you know, to be seeing this at your doctor's office next year or anything. But it's under development, and it's been really promising.
Switching gears, developing countries are starting to feel impacts from climate change, especially in coastal and island areas. You brought us a story on some possible ways to cope with those impacts. So what kind of strategies are you looking here? What kind of things are we talking about to combat the impact of climate change?
Well, I love this story because it just happens that developing countries are not only expected to be the hardest hit by climate change, but they have the fewest resources and the weakest infrastructures to be able to handle it. So our writer went out and found out all these great low-tech ideas. That's the key here. It's low-tech. Most of these projects, you don't require any special training to actually put them into practice. My favorite, it's a floating school. So if you're in a flood-prone area, for not that much money and really, you know, at no there's no downside to this, where you can build a school that floats. So as the floodwaters rise, the children don't have to worry about missing out on education, which is such a key point of breaking the poverty cycle. They can still go to school. They may have to take the boat to school, but their school floats, and it rises as the waters rise. Another great idea I really love, it's called camel hump agriculture. And basically, you have, you know, troughs in between these small raised bed areas for your crops. And in the rainy season, the troughs fill up with water. You can have fish in them that you can not only harvest the fish to eat, but the fish contribute to nutrients to the soil. And then as the drought season hits, the water levels in these troughs go down, but they're nourishing the croplands. So it's, you know, making the most out of a rainy season by actually using it, that excess water, to irrigate during the dry season.
And another consequence of rising ocean levels is salt. Salt in water, contaminating places with already scarce fresh water supplies. There's also a wind-powered, hopefully inexpensive solution for that.
Yeah. You know, right now, reverse osmosis is kind of the way that most people are desalinating water, but it's very expensive. And this is a much lower cost setup where you can actually, the wind really is driving the water through a filtration system that's actually based on copper. So it gets filtered through the copper, and it costs much, much less. It's much easier to set up, too. So that's actually, in certain rural areas in Colombia, it's already being used in a few test cases, and it's just doing fantastic for them.
And my favorite, I think, was permeable dams to sort of, and this is in Indonesia, I think, to mimic the effect of mangrove forests that have gone away, and then to also to help regrow those mangroves.
Yeah, and you know, if you've ever seen a photo of a mangrove forest, you can see how really the roots just extend underneath the surface of the water, and they create this, like, really, it's really cool looking, I think, but this really cool barrier that helps protect not only young mangrove trees, but it reduces soil erosion, it helps protect the ecosystem that's established. Unfortunately, because of things like fishing and agriculture and everything, a lot of mangrove forests have been torn up, and once they're torn up, they're really hard to regrow because the young mangroves are super sensitive to, you know, like big waves or heavy winds. So this is actually using local materials available right there. I think there's a current project in Thailand now where it looks like a fence made of sort of vertical sticks and then layers and layers of horizontal sticks. And this permeable dam actually does what an established mangrove forest would do. So it already is, it's reducing erosion, it's protecting the coastline, and you can also plant young mangroves behind it, and they're protected enough so that as they grow up, they kind of take over that function, and you're restoring a habitat that is really important to restore.
Talking about the latest science news with Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine. We promised violence. Gemma, you wrote 20 facts about violence. First, briefly, why did you tackle violence?
Well, you know, it's one of those things that it seems we talk a lot about violence, and there's a lot of talk about violence on TV, et cetera, et cetera. But there's so many different aspects to it that I think don't get talked about. You know, it's almost cliche to just talk about violence as being the cause of this, or humans being violent, or maybe humans weren't violent until, you know, agriculture started, and maybe hunter-gatherer humans were not violent, and all these different theories, but no one really stops to look at the actual research that's gone into it. So I spent some time doing this, and I came up with a lot of really absolutely fascinating things. My favorite is probably back in 2011, there was a study noting that a lot of quadrupedal species, you know, the usual four on the floor, the dogs, the horses, etc., they rear up when they fight. And they did some research on it and looked at our evolutionary track. And they think it's possible that because when you rear up to fight, you have greater leverage. You know, your strikes actually have more power behind them than if you've got, you know, three legs on the floor and you're striking with one. So they think it's possible that our knuckle-walking ancestors, our partly quadrupedal ancestors, if the males of that species stood upright more, it made them more effective fighters, and maybe it made them better competitors for mates, and maybe they mated more, and maybe that's why you and me and humans around the world are fully bipedal. It's a crazy theory, but it's really fascinating when you think about it.
Another interesting, and this is in the theory realm of warfare, violence may be higher, maybe based in part on risk of parasite infections?
Yes, it's called the parasite stress model. And when you think about it, it makes total sense. If you've got really high rates of infectious disease in your society, that means, you know, it's harder to work if you're sick, or if, say, your breadwinner has passed away or is incapacitated, the family unit breaks down, resources get more scarce, infrastructure breaks down. You've got all these problems, and they found that in areas with high rates of infectious disease, there's more xenophobia, there's more strain of resources, and the risk of conflict is elevated. So there's the question is, can we kind of blame bugs for bugging us so much that we started up warfare? It's possible. And when you think about it, it makes sense.
And finally, why do we like violent entertainment, from the gladiator games to violent movies? Terror management theory. Briefly, Gemma, what is that?
Super briefly, basically, humans are the only species really cognizant of our own mortality, and because of that, that's a scary prospect, we need to build all these defense mechanisms to protect ourselves from just thinking about the void, so to speak, and sometimes those defense mechanisms are very elaborate, and they can be very violent. It's a really fascinating area of psychology.
And for the most part, we are spending more of our time being cooperative and peaceful than we do being violent. Good place to end it.
Look, you and I have been cooperative the past 15 minutes or so, right?
I'd like to think so. Gemma, thank you so much. It's always a lot of fun.
Always fun. Thank you.
That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month to talk about some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science. Coming up after the news, a look at body image, pop culture, and the plus size label. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up, a new report finds risky levels of copper and lead in the drinking water at two Wisconsin prisons. We find out what that means for employees and inmates. First, there's been a lot of conversation lately about body image in pop culture, often playing out on magazine covers. Magazines like Women's Running, Sports Illustrated, Glamour, Maxim, and others have made news by including women on their covers who don't fit the conventional cover model profile, because they're larger than the usual cover model, what's sometimes labeled plus size. But it hasn't always gone over well. Glamour magazine's recent cover included comedian and actor Amy Schumer on what seemed to be a list of plus-size role models. She pointed out online that as she wears sizes 6 to 8, she's not in the usual plus-size category, and she worried what message that might send to women or girls who might think that they should try to be thinner than that. She and others, including actor Melissa McCarthy, have called for an end to the use of the phrase plus-size altogether. Harriet Brown joins us now to talk about this latest episode in the ongoing body image and body size controversy. She's an associate professor of magazine journalism at Syracuse University. Her most recent book is Body of Truth: How Science, History, and Culture Drive Our Obsession with Weight and What We Can Do About It. Harriet, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me again, Rob.
Well, when it comes to body image, Harriet, does it matter who we see in places like magazine covers?
Oh, it absolutely matters, just like it matters in any issue that involves, you know, people who have been marginalized. It matters with race, it matters with ethnicity and gender, and definitely with body size. The more you see one particular norm, as we do, the more normal that looks to you, and the more abnormal other kinds of body sizes tend to look. So, yeah, it's a big deal.
And what kind of impact does that have on women in terms of eating disorders and other problems when they see, as you say, that thing there as a norm that doesn't match them?
Well, I think it has tremendous effects on women in terms of all kinds of things, physical health, psychological health, disordered eating. I mean, we have an epidemic of disordered eating and misery, basically, around the country with women, you know, trying to fit ourselves into this very narrow box of what we should look like, literally and metaphorically. And what happens when you live your whole life feeling like you should look you should be different, look different than you are? You know, it's a recipe for self-loathing, and that is not a recipe for good health on any level, but it definitely can be a huge trigger for disordered eating and a trigger for eating disorders as well.
And we've seen, as I mentioned a few moments ago, a bunch of magazines featuring women on their cover who are what the industry considers plus size. More about that phrase in a few moments. But what do you make of this, what seems to be a change in the way people are thinking about who goes on the cover?
I think it is a great first step, and it is a first step, but it's, you know, and some people have critiqued it as a kind of tokenism, but I think that's part of how we change these big cultural and social ideas. So, you know, magazines have learned that, depending on their audience, they can get some pretty good PR and attention from doing something like that, and I think it's great because it serves, you know, women too. I think, you know, the key will be, can we sort of keep it up, and can women of all body sizes just become women and not, you know, plus size or normal size or haute couture size or whatever?
Yeah, what would it take to get to that point where each individual model who appears on a cover isn't noteworthy, where it's not really something that's standing out and noticeable?
Probably a socialist revolution, honestly, because I think that, you know, one of the big things that perpetuates these problems is the whole advertising and marketing sort of, you know, whirlwind, and the idea that the way to sell products is to create, you know, a sense of anxiety in people, and specifically in women who are taught from a very early age that the thing that matters most about us is the way we look. So, you know, I don't see that happening anytime soon, but, you know, I would love it if it did.
Does that make sense, though, in a way? Because, you know, you see Melissa McCarthy, the actor, saying she's coming out with a clothing line that's going to try be something that looks good on, ideally, all women of all shapes and sizes. She avoids the phrase plus size. Mm-hmm. In researching this, I saw somebody criticizing Victoria's Secret, saying, okay, if you're only going to have these sizes, if you're going to focus on these models and these images, there's this potentially lucrative market that you're missing out on.
Right, and that has been one of the arguments for, you know, efforts like McCarthy's. But I think to understand it, you have to remember that a big part of the appeal of fashion, especially haute couture and high fashion, is it's not just about the clothes, it's about the status that comes with the clothes. And since we live in a culture where it is easier to be, you know, I don't even know how to say it, like, quote, normal size, quote, larger size, whatever you want to call it, than it is to be super, super thin, like the models, you know, we see on the cover of Vogue and everything. So then that condition of rarity becomes the higher status condition. So in other words, you know, a lot of fashion designers don't want the money that might come from selling to larger women because they want to maintain the status and the allure of only selling to the exclusive few.
We're talking about popular culture, body image, and what shapes and sizes of models are on the cover of magazines. There's been a lot of talk, some controversy over that lately. Harriet Brown is with us. Her latest book is Body of Truth, How Science, History, and Culture Drive Our Obsession with Weight and What We Can Do About It. Well, Harriet, let's get to the phrase I keep dancing around with, throwing in quotes, plus size. It's something that gets used a lot. People talk about plus size models now on Sports Illustrated and other magazines. What do you think of that phrase that some people are saying, hey, let's stop using it?
Yeah, I mean, the words that we use really matter a lot. And I know that the reason people protest against plus size is the same reason people protest against words like overweight, because it sort of suggests by inference that there's a normal weight or a normal size to be and you are in some other category. You know, people feel very strongly about these words. Personally, the words don't particularly bother me, although I don't use the word plus size. I like the word fat, basically, but a lot of people are bothered by that word. So, you know, I try to pick my battles with this stuff, and the word plus size is not one of the most important things. But I do see where people are coming from with that.
Right. I would imagine that a lot of the people who use plus size are doing it because they worry about overweight or fat being the more offensive label.
Right. And, you know, as with any kind of language like that, there's, you know, depending on your audience, people are going to feel very differently. So, you know, it just kind of depends. I know the supermodel Emmy Aronson, who was one of the first, quote, plus-size models, she, I think she uses the word, although she also uses the word curvy. So, you know, it just kind of depends.
And then this Amy Schumer Glamour magazine thing, it implied that she was on a list of positive role models who are plus-size, but in that case is used to describe someone who it appears is around the average size for American women, maybe even on the low side.
Oh, she's
there.
Way smaller right. than the average American woman.
Yeah, so do you see that as harmful when plus size has a bit of mission creep there?
I do, and I think that a lot of people have taken offense to her protest because they think she's saying, I'm not fat, you know, or I'm not plus size. But I actually think she's making a different point because she's been very upfront about her, you know, about body image, and she uses it a lot for comedy material. But I think it's a really good point. What does it mean in our culture when someone who wears a size 6 to 8, which is, you know, again, really much smaller than the average American woman, is suddenly labeled plus size? I mean, there's also different markets. So, like, that's definitely plus size for haute couture, where it's like a size 0 to 2 maybe at the most. But, you know, come on. I mean, I think Glamour probably would have gotten in less hot water if they had labeled it like body advocates or body positive advocates or something. And why have to comment on the size of people's bodies at all, right?
Now, Sports Illustrated was another entry in this this conversation. In their swimsuit edition, one of the cover models was Ashley Graham, often described as a plus-size model. I don't think she liked that phrase. But then backlash, a former model, Cheryl Teague, said it's unhealthy to have plus-size models on. And here's a quote. She says, I don't like that we're talking about full-figured women because it's glamorizing them, because your waist should be smaller than 35 inches. Now, she subsequently apologized after backlash to that, but this is a common reaction, this kind of health concern, and this is something you've talked a lot about, Harriet.
Yeah, and that's a bogus reaction. I mean, if people were really concerned about the health of women who are in larger bodies, they'd be saying much different things and acting in much different ways. I think a much more likely explanation for the reaction of Teagues and other people like that is that it's the reaction that you get when you have some privilege and someone questions it, right? So if you're a person who has devoted a lot of time and energy and money and attention in your life to fitting into a particular, you know, in Teagues' case, she's been a model and an actress, so, you know, presumably she devotes a fair amount of time and energy on maintaining a certain body. And if someone comes along and suddenly says, wait a minute, that's, you don't really have to do that, you know, it doesn't necessarily make you healthier or more attractive, that can be very threatening. And I think that's at least a part of what we're hearing in those reactions.
We're talking to Harriet Brown about body image, popular culture, and the rise of so-called plus-size models on magazine covers. A lot of conversation over the last week from Sports Illustrated to Glamour and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of that phrase, plus-size? If you've shopped in that category, how does it make you feel? You okay with it? You don't like it? And when you see models on magazine covers, maybe you're in that grocery checkout line, you see models of different sizes than the typical cover, what do you think? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Harriet Brown about body image in the American media and the debate over phrases like plus size. It's been an issue on magazine covers over the last few days, last few months, years too, really. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you glad when you see magazines like Women's Running, Glamour, Sports Illustrated featuring models of different shapes and sizes? What do you think of the phrase plus size? And does what we see on magazine covers and on TV and the movies affect the way we think about body image? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Taryn is with us in Green Deer. Taryn, hi.
Hello.
What do you think?
Well, I was, first of all, I wanted to comment on the terminology. And since I have kind of an issue with this whole topic, I think for me, lean and healthy is really ultimately where it's at. Years ago, I watched the Puppy Bowl, and I realized we're all kind of different types of dogs. You know, you're never going to have a poodle puppy that that's from a Great Dane. You know what I'm saying? We're just different builds. So as long as it's lean and healthy, I think that that's optimal. But I wanted to mention, too, that I used to be an actress, and I heard all the time, you could just lose 10 pounds. And it was really difficult, and I did a lot of shoots for Harper's Bazaar. It was impossible for me to stay at the weight that they expected.
Taryn, thanks a lot for that call. So a lot there, Harriet. First of all, somebody in that line of work facing a real struggle just to meet that standard.
Yeah, and I think most people in that line of work face those struggles. You know, I don't think it's easy for anyone, really. But and I love the caller's point about that we're all kind of like different breeds of dogs. And I would just take it a step further and say lean is not what some of us are naturally, right? And so, and the health research does not support the fact that being lean is always better for your health. So, you know, it's more complicated, basically.
Taryn, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Christine in La Crosse. Christine, hi.
Hi. I just want to say, well, I guess I would be what you consider more on the petite side, but I think it's great that they have models of all different sizes, because I think it's important for women to have options of different clothing to wear to make them feel confident and feel pretty. And I see so many women try to fit into sizes that they aren't because society tells them that that's what they should be wearing, and it doesn't look nice because it's not meant for their body type.
Christine, thanks for that call. Harriet, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Why wouldn't we have clothes that could make everybody happy and feel good and comfortable, right? It seems like a pretty basic idea, so I agree with the caller.
I want to get to another magazine. I mentioned Women's Running Magazine, and they've gotten some press. They've had a couple cover models who don't fit what had been their normal profile, which I think people described as skinny and athletic. Here's a quote from the editor. Quote, there's a stereotype that all runners are skinny. That's not the case. Runners come in all shapes and sizes. You can only go to any race finish line, 5K to a marathon, and see that. And she says, it was important for us to celebrate that. I think that every woman goes to the magazine rack and sometimes feels like she can't see herself in the cover images. So what do you think of that approach?
I think it's fantastic, actually. And I think that it really speaks to this stereotype that we have, that healthy is always lean, and that fat people are lazy and they just eat too much and they never exercise. And in fact, what a lot of people in larger bodies say is that when they do exercise, if they go to the gym or they're running outside or whatever, they're often the objects of ridicule, which kind of goes back to the idea that this isn't really about concern for people's health. Because if we were really concerned and thought it was good that people were running, no matter what their bodies looked like, we'd be encouraging them, not mooing at them or making fun of them. So I think it's fantastic, and I'm all for it.
Talking to Harriet Brown, her latest book is Body of Truth, and we're looking at a body image and popular culture, the images of women that we see in the media, in places like magazine covers. That's been a big conversation lately. We'll go back to our callers now with Linda in Milwaukee. Linda, hi.
Hi. I'm a quote-unquote plus-size person. I don't mind the term at all. What I do mind is trying to go to the stores where it seems like they hide. They hide all of the larger clothes, like they want to hide us and push us way far away from all of the other different sizes.
Linda, thanks for the call. And is that, Harriet, do you think that's a layout? Is that an intentional thing at stores?
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, some stores have been very transparent about it, like American Eagle, I think, you know, where they don't want people who they don't consider attractive, and that usually means larger bodies in their stores. It's like there's a disease that people would be catching. Because, you know, it doesn't lead to that sort of exclusive look, I suppose. So, yeah, she's absolutely right.
Linda, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Rocky with us in Nishkoro. Rocky, hi.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Now, what do you think, Rocky?
Well, I was wondering why they just have the large size. Why don't they have the negative size of the models that are skinny?
So move the scale, so negative numbers, and moving the meter, I guess, a little bit, Harriet?
Yeah, I mean, I think that anything that stigmatizes, makes people feel bad about their bodies is probably not a great idea. So I, in theory, I appreciate it, but in practice, I think, you know, I don't know. It's kind of hard because then you're left with, well, how do you assign numbers? I mean, and it kind of makes you think these numbers on sizes are all pretty meaningless anyway. We could start them anywhere. We could start them at 500 and sort of go up from there. So,
Rocky, thanks for the call. I had seen an article recently about a woman's clothing company. I can't remember what kind of clothing, but they, instead of having size ranges or plus sizes, they had categories like beautiful, gorgeous, and something else, trying to take numbers and values out of it, though I saw some complaints that, well, how do you know which one you are? There's nothing implicit in those words that tells you which size range you should be shopping in. But is there a range of adjectives, or is the word, the label, not the important thing?
I don't think it is the important thing, really. And, I mean, I think, like, I know when I shop for clothes online, I don't pay any attention to sizes. I just look at their size chart and the measurements and sort of say, okay, what will my body fit into? So maybe that's the best way. I don't know.
Well, stepping back into popular culture, Harriet, and these magazine covers and what's inside the magazines, too, is this a case where the fashion industry, the modeling industry, the photographers, the editors are setting an agenda in a way? They're setting the body ideal, or are they reflecting what they think their readers, their public wants them to have in the magazine?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think inevitably it's a little of both, but I do think that media and fashion industries definitely set the agenda. A lot of it devolves from that, and so while... And it's a perfect example of what is known as hegemony, which is basically when you take an idea and sort of make it the norm. You're not, like, overtly telling people, you all must look like this, but you kind of get people to believe that about themselves, and then they wind up policing themselves. And that's absolutely what has happened with all, you know, how we feel about our bodies. So it's an interaction. It's both. But I think that, you know, the fashion industries could actually help quite a bit, and so could media.
And Harriet, briefly as we wrap up, you've been writing about these issues a long time. As you see it, do you think things moving maybe even slowly in a positive direction?
I do. I think it's a different conversation now than it was 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, but I think it's going to be a long-term conversation and a long-term shift, but I am hopeful, though.
We'll leave it there for now. Harriet, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've been talking to Harriet Brown. She's Associate Professor of Magazine Journalism at Syracuse University. Her latest book is Body of Truth, How Science, History, and Culture Drive Our Obsession with Weight and What We Can Do About It. Still time for you to weigh in on the issues we've been talking about, the issues she's been raising. Head on over to the Central Time Facebook page and share your thoughts there. A Wisconsin rock legend got international recognition this weekend, but he wasn't totally happy about it. Milwaukee-born Steve Miller of the Steve Miller Band was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That was Friday night. In his 8-minute acceptance speech, he thanked his musical inspirations, his bandmates, and his crew, and he name-checked his alma mater.
Later in college, the University of Wisconsin... I was a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. I was a freedom rider and a war protester.
But after the ceremony, he talked to the press and opened up on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He was unhappy that his band didn't get free tickets to the event. He said a lot of the legal fine points were left unresolved, and publicists tried to interrupt him. According to a journalist on the scene, he said, "No, we're not going to wrap this up. I'm going to wrap you up. You sit over there and learn something." He went on, "This is how close the show came to not happening because the artists are being treated right now. So I'll wrap it up." Well, we'll wrap it up now until the news with the Steve Miller Band on Central Time.